Hello, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
Peter? I don't know if you were trying to grow a Freddie Mercury-esque mustache for the occasion, or if this is something that's been happening for a while.
Nope, it's just midterm season, so just a lack of shaving.
It's midterm, so you stop shaving, like yeah. It's the playoffs.
Too busy writing, man. A good time for that.
All right, that's fine. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new musical drama biopic Bohemian Rhapsody. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including Gladiator 2. We're finally making a sequel to the 20-year-old Oscar winner where everyone died. So what the hell?
Yeah, spoilers.
Spoilers for Gladiator. And then Warner Media is canceling Filmstruck. It's a streaming service in the U.S. that hosts movie classics in the Criterion Collection. Is this corporate greed or proof that there's a limit to how many streaming services we'll pay for? And then finally, the details of the Game of Thrones prequel series has been announced, but do we need a Game of Thrones prequel, or is there a potential here? We will talk about all those, but first, Netflix has blinked. And by that, I mean Hollywood has been sort of in a mood with Netflix, because Netflix has gotten into the original film content game and has been doing what's called time and day release, where they will put the film available on Netflix the same day they release it in a handful of theaters, this theoretically to make them eligible for awards consideration, but Hollywood has been quite displeased because, I should say the Hollywood establishment has been quite displeased because it's felt like Netflix is trying to edge out theaters, and going to the theater is sort of the whole point.
I don't know, it might accomplish it. It wouldn't surprise me.
Well, I mean, this is the thing, is that... Netflix has announced that they are going to do one-week theatrical runs for three big movies. One is Roma, which is the new Alfonso Cuarón picture. The second one is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is the new Coen brothers.
Ooh.
And Bird Box is the third one, and it stars Sandra Bullock, and she's been getting a lot of awards buzz for her her work in that. So Roma is going to be out in theaters in... limited release starting November 23rd. It comes out on Netflix on December 14th. And then the other two films will come out in theaters 8 days before they're available on Netflix.
Oh, before they're available on Netflix.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering why I hadn't heard about these. I'm browsing through Netflix 24/7. Haven't seen them.
Yeah, no, they haven't come out on Netflix 24/7 as you're writing midterms.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. I had to watch some Netflix instead of The Shaving. And Freddie Mercury.
All right, back to the news. It does sound like we have sort of the new media admitting defeat, slight defeat to the old media, because this is what has gotten a lot of people upset about Netflix, and not upset about, say, Amazon, which does do a theatrical release before it ends up on Amazon.
Big Sick.
Yeah, Big Sick. The Noah Baumbach movie, whose name I can't remember, with Casey Affleck that he won the Oscar for, is yet another one. Last couple of Woody Allen movies.
Oh, Manchester by the Sea?
Manchester by the Sea.
Yes. Yeah, that one was good. You know, this might end up, you know, meeting one of the people who's responsible for Netflix taking over everything. But in a lot of ways, it's the Academy. It's other, ceremonies that can nominate a film that don't accept streaming. They accepted streaming. Netflix wouldn't have to be putting their movies everywhere in a bunch of different theaters, right?
Right. But it's...
it would still be separate, so it would maintain, films in theaters, but Netflix could still deservedly get the noms.
Right, but in the past, there's always been sort of loopholes to this, right? Which is that... you wanted your movie up for Oscar consideration, you would release it like Phantom Thread, which came out in like two theaters, one in New York, one in LA, like the week before December 31st, and it's like, boom, it was released this year. So it counts in the Oscars, and then it comes out everywhere else in like January, February. So it's, yeah, I mean, part of it is sort of that old, I guess, prejudice, you know, against the streaming. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's part of it, too, is I want to defend cinema is what I want to do. But I want to, but, you know.
Oh, I love cinemas, too.
It's part of, I mean, yeah, Netflix is, you know, obviously funding these films and giving these creators, in some cases, unprecedented creative control. I mean, there's a reason mm-hmm. why Alfonso Cuarón goes to Netflix, and or the Coen brothers go to Netflix, or Martin Scorsese goes to Netflix to make something like The Irishman.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited for that one.
But yeah, so there's that part of it too. On the one hand, Netflix should sort of be applauded for being that bold and like letting creators like and funding creators' vision.
Yeah, do what they want.
But on the back end, you have Khan basically saying, "Well, we're not going to screen Netflix in competition because you don't honor the theatrical experience." Well, Amazon skates. I mean, because
Amazon didn't get any hate for Big Sick, so I think no. It's just Netflix is getting some, you know.
Well, and again, it was also the fact that Amazon will put it out in theaters, and then 3 months later, we'll put it on Amazon for all to see. So theoretically, I mean, it's
a bit more of a gap than Netflix is planning.
Right. So it's the time delay because Amazon wants you to go to Amazon to watch those things. They don't necessarily mm-hmm. want you to go to the theater, but because they're trying to, I guess maybe they play the game better than Netflix. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, the trend with these tech things, tech companies tends to be, and this is why this is particularly intriguing, is that they steamroll over with the new rules because, you know, Netflix could easily be credited with putting video stores out of business, Blockbuster out of business.
Well, yeah.
So
100%. Way to go, Netflix.
So, you know, that's where the, you know, where this is different. Here Netflix is saying, "Okay, we'll play your game," which mm-hmm. is goes against sort of the ideals of these big tech giants, which is, "No, we're not going to play your game. We're going to play our game." Mm-hmm. And we're going to put you out of business, basically.
I don't know if that's what Netflix is trying to say. I think they just want some award that they deserve.
Right, but yeah. But here they're saying that they can't win the awards by doing the steamroll thing. They were having to play the Hollywood game.
Yeah, but that's
and
not...
Hollywood's wanted them to play the Hollywood game.
Yeah, but that's not like the rule they made, right? So I feel that Netflix has to do that. So that's why I don't understand why like Netflix is getting so much hate. The people giving the hate to Netflix could just make it so that streaming just can get noms itself. Or even like a separate category.
For best streaming movie?
I guess, yeah. That wouldn't be really fair to these films either, though.
Yeah, that kind of gets us back into the best popular movie
kind
of stuff. Because, you know, obviously people are watching more movies at home than, you know, going to the theater. But
I think, like you said, the worry is just if that's allowed, Netflix films, not in theaters, but just streaming to get noms, might destroy Hollywood as we know it, you know, in theaters. But I don't know if that's the case. I don't know.
No,
only
I know.
One way to find out.
No, I mean, I think what we're seeing is that the theater is more like an appointment engagement things. It's not like, let's go to the movies tonight. You sort of make a plan in advance because you're going to see something big like one of the Marvel movies or one, you know, something like Fantastic Beasts coming out in a couple of weeks. It, you know, it's these big tentpole things. Oh, yeah, for Fantastic Beasts.
Oh, yeah.
All right. But, the you know, it's that kind of feeling versus you know, just kind of stumbling upon. People don't really stumble upon things as much anymore is the feeling, you know. Even on Netflix, it's hard to stumble upon things because it's so hard.
Yeah. Well, especially on the TV Netflix. Belle, if you're listening, you got to fix that up, man. You can't search categories. You just have to scroll through. So, yeah, Netflix really makes it so there's so much you can watch, but it just makes you see what already gets the most amount of views, right?
Even
the indie ones. Yeah. It's the indie ones that get the most amount of reviews. So
don't get me started about Belle. I've had a week with them.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about something a bit more fun. Gladiator 2.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, for Glenn. No, let's talk about Gladiator 2. So it's been reported that they're working on a sequel to Gladiator, which came out in 2000. won the Oscar. Russell Crowe won the Oscar for playing the title character. So Ridley Scott looks like he's going to come back to direct. Peter Craig is currently writing the script. They're kind of Russian-ness because it sounds like it might be Ridley Scott's next film. Peter Craig, not exactly a marquee screenwriter, but he's also the guy who wrote Top Gun 2, which is currently in production.
Oh, the upcoming one, yeah.
So I guess he's the guy you get when you want to bring a sequel for an old movie.
Yeah, very old movie. And for Gladiator, the two main characters died, like you said, in the first one.
Yeah.
So why, of all his films, why pick this one?
Well, it's supposed to focus on the son of Connie Nielsen's character was the nephew of the Joaquin Phoenix villain.
Commodus,
yeah.
Yeah. I hope there's at least maybe some flashbacks. It'd be fun seeing Joaquin Phoenix and Russell Crowe again. And I don't know if Russell Crowe's that busy.
So. I don't know if Russell Crowe like cares about like this kind of thing anymore.
I don't think he does.
You know, he's doing weird choices. Like, yeah, on the one hand, he's doing like The Nice Guys, which he was great in.
Yeah, that was good.
And then he's doing like stuff like Man of Steel and The Mummy.
He's going all over the place.
He's playing, you know, Dr. Jekyll and The Mummy, who's basically the Nick Fury for this dark universe that was supposed to be created.
I think it's just a Nicolas Cage thing where he picked, like, some not good ones, too much not good ones in a row.
He's in his Nicolas Cage phase.
Yeah, he's in his Nicolas Cage, but he could have a comeback, like Nicolas Cage. Comeback-ish.
Speaking of another Nick, the reason I find this interesting, because a couple of years ago, Nick Cave wrote a script for a Gladiator sequel where, and I'm not kidding you, because you can find the script online and read it, but where Russell Crowe's character Maximus goes to the afterlife, but the gods sent him back to Earth because they are dying because of this new kid on the block who's creating a new religion, and his name was Jesus Christ.
Oh my goodness.
So basically the old gods send Maximus to Earth to kill Jesus. Nick Cave wanted
to kill Jesus.
Yeah, Nick Cave wanted to be called the Christ Killer.
Well, that would have been during in Roman times, like the Nero era, and when there was the, you know, the Christianity, and a lot of them were getting killed. So it would have been unfortunately historically accurate.
Yeah. But then through the course of the story, Maximus sees the error of his ways, but then he becomes an eternal warrior, and then we see scenes of him fighting like in various armies across time. Up through, like, modern times, Vietnam.
Ooh, I don't know. World War II. No, okay. I'm glad that did not happen.
No. And it ends with him. I think this is right. I think it ends with him being a general in the Pentagon on 9/11.
Oh, my gosh. it'd be an interesting film. I hope a Russell Crowe fan makes a shot-for-shot film of that just on YouTube. That'd be funny.
I want to see that one. Yeah. I actually put on Twitter, it's like the Nick Cave script or GTFO. It's just, you know, I don't want to see like a serious like Gladiator 2 with, you know, the grown-up kid from Gladiator 1 who's like, I met a man named Maximus who taught me the value of honor. My uncle was evil and now I don't know what to do with my life. I don't want to watch that movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's just kind of questioning everything.
Yeah. That has no interest to. I mean, and then
he's not even really ridiculously close connected to Russell Crowe's character, right?
No,
like he's just inspired by him.
He's a fan.
Yeah,
he's a fanboy. Because there's that scene where he meets Maximus, and he doesn't know who Maximus is because Maximus was his grandfather's like most trusted general, but he doesn't know, and he sees Maximus's armor, and they're talking about the horses on the armor and how Maximus lost his horses. Somebody took his horses away. Metaphor alert. And,
yeah, very obvious metaphor.
And, you know, he becomes like a Maximus fan. He's like, I will cheer for you, Spartan, because he's not going by the name Maximus. But, so he was the Spaniard. Russell Crowe, Australian, somehow the Spaniard. Okay. But no, it's. I don't want that movie. It's like, Maximus taught me the value of honor. Mm-hmm. No. I want to see Russell Crowe as Maximus battle across time. I want to see him at, like, I don't know, the Alamo.
Maybe more entertaining.
Like Antietam. Let's throw some, like, Battle of Vimy in there. Like
Spanish Civil War?
Yeah, he's there. Hundred Years War, 7 Years War. Let's make him like Mel Gibson in The Patriot. He was there. Like, just make it crazy. I want to see a crazy Gladiator sequel.
Yeah, you could. Hey, you can make it.
Oh, I can make it.
Yeah, you can make it.
I didn't realize I had the rights. Okay.
I also just want to say though, like, I'll probably watch this if it comes out. But like, I just want to see Ridley Scott maybe do an original film again. It's been a while. Even Prometheus was original-ish.
Well, it was
it connected to Alien.
Well, it wasn't like explicitly like we're. In the same way, like, two cop shows set in New York are necessarily connected. But, Prometheus has its moments.
Oh, I personally loved it. I was very disappointed with Alien Covenant. It's supposed to be a continuation of the Prometheus.
A lot of people were.
I know, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, that's another thing. It's like he's going back to the well. He's going back to Gladiator. And it's like, has that worked before? You went back to Aliens twice.
He seems to enjoy it.
You know, you went back to Blade Runner, and I think Blade Runner 2049 was really good, but it wasn't a success.
No, it didn't make as much as I thought it would.
Anyway.
Yeah. We'll see what he accomplishes.
Ridley Scott doesn't need career advice from us. Or maybe, maybe he does. So, for film nerds out there who like to look at the classics and enjoy the classics, there was this service called Filmstruck available in the United States. And what it had was all these classic movies that were in the Turner catalog. So all these like movies from the 30s and 40s and 50s, you can see them on TCM, the cable channel that shows Turner Classic Movies. But they also had access to the Criterion catalog. And if you don't know what that is, it's a sort of a curatational service that puts out DVD copies of movies they think that are cultural or historically important. Mm-hmm. So they'll put out things by Ingmar Bergman, but they'll also put out Criterion versions of The Rock
and Armageddon.
And Kevin Smith. Too, yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of Kevin Smiths. There's also, I think pretty much every Wes Anderson movie has a Criterion collection. Mm-hmm. So it like runs the gamut.
Yeah, it's a wide array. Akira Kurosawa and like really old people too. But then like I said, yeah, newer people.
And they just
pick really good films.
I actually have the Criterion of Armageddon.
Oh, really?
I sought it out. It's out of print, but I was able to get one.
That's cool.
I don't know if it's cool.
I think it's cool. You think it's cool.
All right, fair enough. They put all this on a streaming service called Filmstruck. Last week they announced that Filmstruck is going to be canceled at the end of the month. This was sadly never available to Canadians, but there are sort of two minds of this. One is that this is Warner Brothers sort of being greedy, or rather AT&T, who bought Warner Brothers and bought all this. It was a Warner Brothers service. AT&T has trying to consolidate a lot of these things, a lot of these niche streaming services. There was one that they canceled that did like Korean movies. The other flip side of this is that there are too many streaming services.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Especially in the States. Yeah. It's ridiculous. I'm, in a weird way, I'm actually kind of glad we don't get all of them. I'd be paying way more per month, I'll tell you that.
No, sure. Yeah. It's.
I don't think we have Hulu yet, do we?
Not in Canada.
No, we got Amazon Prime, which is, you know.
And there's a ton of stuff on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. We get Amazon Prime. There's Crave TV, which is a Canadian invention owned by Bell Media.
Yeah, and Sony Crackle.
We get Crackle here, that's right. We get Shudder, which is horror movies.
Mm-hmm. That one's really good.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And Netflix, of course. But, I mean, there's more coming down the pike because there's the Disney streaming service, which is going to have all Disney. So if you want to watch anything Disney or 20th Century Fox or Marvel or Pixar, there's going to be one place to do that. Yeah. That's coming next year. And
I'm a little excited for that.
Well,
I agree with you that it will be, you know, taking over the old classic, good old Hollywood that we know.
What it's becoming is like, you know, people are cutting the cord on the cable boxes because, you know, you have to buy, if you want to, there are so many channels where you like watch one thing, but you have to buy that channel if you want to watch that one thing. And
YouTube, Netflix both have channels now. Crave TV, as of last week, has channels as well that just like
they shows. Changed the movie network to being Crave branded, which is stupid.
So it's even the streaming is even sort of taking over cable TV.
Yeah, I mean, Bell Media and CBC both do this annoying thing. Like, you'll see the buses out here with the "and with an E" advert on it, and it says "and with an E, streaming Sunday at 8 p.m. And it's like, that's not what streaming means. Mm-mm. Why are you using this word in a way that it doesn't mean this? You don't stream something at a specific day at a specific time on your TV through your cable box. You stream it on the freaking internet
whenever you want to.
Yes.
As long as, I guess, you know, not pre-release. Well, pre-release, you know, handycam. But, yeah, no, that's bad. That's bad.
Yeah, going into a movie theater and pirating things is bad. I'm glad Peter had that disclaimer. but the thing is, the cultural thing, is that it's becoming really hard to find older things. It's like, if you want to find, I don't know, Jurassic World, it's on demand, it's on Netflix, it's at your library if your library carries a big video collection like the Guelph Public Library does.
That is one of the only reasons I'm okay with the Disney streaming. There will be a lot of old classic Disneys that aren't available on any of the streamings, specifically a lot of the really, you know, pre-movie short ones.
Are they doing that?
Well, they're probably going to be doing it. It's Disney streaming, right? If they don't do that, like, that'd be really stupid.
It would be stupid, but I wonder if there's a demand for that, other than film nerds.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, there's a reason they don't put out Song of the South, right? It's not, and granted, because Song of the South is racist, but they would only sell like a few hundred copies to like hardcore film nerds.
Maybe not the shorts then, yeah. But I think if it does have its old movies, it's going to have ones like Aristocats.
Right.
So ones that aren't, you know, as well remembered as 70s. Little Mermaid. Yeah, but they'll have ones like Aristocats. They're still, I have friends who love it. Like, it's still well known.
It's because it's from the 70s.
Yeah.
It's not exactly like the wartime cartoons that they put out.
Oh, when I said shorts, I was talking more like, you know, like the pre-Toy Story or older, like pre their first one, Snow White, but not... Not those ones where you see the World War II and you see the... No, there's some real...
This is a good lesson to the listeners that old is relative.
Yeah, if it's before Snow White and it's Disney, maybe don't watch it.
but there's still value to that. And there's very few platforms where you can... Like, Netflix has a section for classic movies, but there's maybe like 50 titles there. And it tend to be titles that are fairly easily available. Whereas Filmstruck had things that you can't get on DVD because, you know, there's really no impetus to, you know, go to the trouble of mastering something into a digital format or a high-def format, sending it to the printer, pressing the discs, and shipping it out. That's, you know, a lot of money. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, I think that may be the saddest point of all, because when we think of streaming, we think of just what's new, what's hip, you know, what's being made right now. Netflix is dumping a ton of money into making original content, not necessarily into buying back catalogs of things, mostly because that's expensive, and studios have made that expensive. But it just makes it harder to find things that are otherwise not relatively well available. Anyway.
Yeah.
Let's go to the last topic, which is the Game of Thrones. Actually, it was
the best topic.
The best topic. Because it was actually a pretty busy week for Game of Thrones news.
Yeah.
Because there was the Entertainment Weekly cover that previewed season 8. There was Donald Trump, like, getting into trouble from HBO for using Game of Thrones trademarks and sanctioning Iran. Mm-hmm. And there was this news that the spin-off, The Long Night, which is actually a prequel, it takes place 1,000 years before the present Game of Thrones series, is going to go into production in February. Jane Goldman, who co-wrote Stardust and Kick-Ass and X-Men First Class with Matthew Vaughn, is the creator of it, and she created it with George R.R. Martin.
Ooh.
And the first person cast is none other than Naomi Watts.
I know that right there. Surprised the heck out of me. She's Naomi Watts. Like, she's still at the prime of her career, because she could be doing, you know, A-list films or some, you know, Oscar-nom films. But I'm glad she's picking this. I love her as an actress. And she was in the Twin Peaks 2017, so she's she is getting into TV, but she's picking some really, you know, specific, in my opinion, high quality ones. She was my favorite character in the newest season, and she is very present.
That storyline was the best part of it.
Yeah, it was.
It was also the one that got closure. There was actual closure.
Perfect closure too.
And
that's just so I know that she's, you know, great in the movie. She's great at TV. And she'll be the main character, right?
I would assume.
Like, yeah, name not... unknown and everything like that. So I'm very, very interested. Yeah,
the character description is that she is a socialite with a secret. And there was a post on Screen Rant that suggested that maybe she plays like the... sort of like the original matriarch of the Lannisters.
Which yeah, the one who formed the
blonde
name.
Blonde hair, obviously.
Well, they said in it that the original male who formed Lannister and went to Castle Rock and formed it will be in it. So it wouldn't surprise me if she's the daughter or I guess could be his wife.
Right. There's the... I don't know the whole Game of Thrones lore because I haven't read the books. I just know the TV show. But that Casterly Rock, which is the Lannister homeland, was founded by someone named Casterly, and then some Lannister tricked him out of it or conned him out of it. So she might be connecting that. This I mean, the thing I find this interesting versus a lot of prequels is that it takes place at the end of the Age of Heroes and before the titular Long Night, which is was a particularly long winter, I think. But this is like an era where like a lot of the stuff, like Bran the Builder and...
The OG.
The OG, yeah. The people who like...
I'm curious who's going to play him.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, because there could be a lot of fun options. Jeff Goldblum? I don't think that would work.
It would be interesting if they got the actor who like actually plays Bran, and because it would be, I mean, it's kind of strongly implied that Bran the Builder is like a wizard.
Oh, because he'd be older.
Yeah,
well, that's what you mean. Yeah, and there is, you know, the theory that he's not Bran the Builder, but the person who kind of built Winterfell too, right?
Yeah, he built the wall in Winterfell.
Yeah, no. I thought you were saying you'd be interested in seeing Bran Stark play the character,
the actor who plays Bran
exactly,
Stark.
Exactly, yeah. Because it could be the same Bran.
There's also that theory that Bran the Builder and Bran Stark are one and the same. That it's like a here's a way back reference that in Babylon 5 where Jeffrey Sinclair like goes back in time to be the leader of the Minbari.
It could be like that.
That was a deep cut.
This one seems like it's going to be at least a bit more deeply connected to the books.
Yeah,
It mentioned there's going to be a lot of Essos.
Yeah,
right. So where Daenerys, you know, lived.
Spend most of the series.
Most of it.
So there's that too.
The Azor Ahai. So if you've read the books, they do give a little mentions to him, the swordsman.
Right. I mean, and that's why it's interesting, is because a lot of the, you know, where the series and where the characters and where the various houses are based on this mythology of when this takes place. So can it like undermine that, and maybe things that, you know, are taken as fact in the modern Game of Thrones, quote unquote modern Game of Thrones, is sort of undermined or shown to be false or shown to be legend in the series. Anyway,
I don't think that'll be the case. But also, I just want to say for this, the main thing I'm excited for is if they delve into Southeros, because this is back in the day when Southeros would have been pretty big too. And I don't know; it's been a while since I read it. I don't know if they mention this, you know, winter hitting Southeros. That'd be really cool, because even like the current present day Game of Thrones, apparently there's still dragons down there and really crazy creatures, right?
That's like
I hope they delve into it.
That's like on the other side of Essos, right? Yeah we'll see.
Yeah, it's apparently got zombies there too, and it's just got a lot like crazy little pirates with fangs. It's the little small references of it in the books are a lot of fun.
All right. So, before we go to break, I just want to mention, starting on Monday, November 12th, Raise Your Voice is starting, and that is, it used to be the annual fundraising drive for CFRU. It is being brought back this year, and we're aiming to raise $5,000 to ensure that the mobile studio can continue on and is bringing radio and community partnerships to a lot of marginalized communities in our town. So it's fairly important that it does keep on trucking, so to speak. There will be more details. You'll hear about it if you listen to CFRU shows in the weeks, but the official launch is on Monday. And you can go to CFRU.ca for all the details, and we'll talk more about it next week when the fundraising drive is on. So that will run from the 12th to the 24th. And as I said, check out CFRU.ca for details there. In the meantime, here on End Credits, we are going to go to our review, but first play a little bit of music to warm us up. And you will remember the tune, but not necessarily the arena.
That better be what it is.
That's not what it is, and you ruined it.
Sorry.
All right. So I'm going to play the music and then come back with a review of Bohemian Rhapsody. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Some peace someday. I got mud on your face. Big disgrace. Somebody better put you back into your place. Singing.
Stamp to this beat. Come on. Now, I want you to clap on the third beat.
What's going on?
You know if you're on time.
I want to give the audience a song that they can perform. So what can they do? Imagine thousands of people doing this in unison. Huh? Well,
what's the lyric?
That was a clip from Bohemian Rhapsody. It is the new film from maybe Bryan Singer. And it stars Rami Malek, Lucy Boynton, Gwilym Lee, Ben Hardy, Joseph Mazzello, Aidan Gillen, Alan Leach, and Mike Myers. So I say maybe because if you're not familiar, Bryan Singer was basically fired with 2 weeks to spare in principal photography. And then Dexter Fletcher, who is the man who's making the Elton John biopic Rocket Man.
They're connected.
And there's actually, I believe there's a brief cameo of Taron Egerton as Elton John. Taron Egerton plays Elton John in Rocket Man.
When we talk about it later, there's also, and I was thinking about during the film, there's a possibility of Mike Myers playing the same character
in the Rocket Man.
Yeah.
It's true. This is, I believe it went to a Directors Guild ruling, and they said Bryan Singer gets sole credit, even though Dexter Fletcher basically finished the movie. I think the drama behind the scenes is probably more compelling than the drama on screen.
I don't know if I agree with that.
All right, I admit,
what do you mean by compelling in the drama? Like to pay attention to?
I think that. Okay, I there's several thoughts I have. One is that I don't know if this film wants to be a Freddie Mercury biopic or a Queen biopic, because I think that a lot of attention is paid to Freddie Mercury. Of course, he was the leader of Queen, so that's understandable, but I don't feel like we really get into the lives of Brian May or Roger or, you know, any sort of anyone else really in the band. The other thing is that the various obstacles to the band, I think, were like conflated, like the whole breakup scene, which didn't actually happen.
It wasn't a breakup, but they did take a break in real
life. They took a break, but you know, there was an animosity about it. They were all burnt out.
There was some small things that didn't actually happen in real life, but that perfectly flowed into the film and made it represent Queen and Freddie Mercury in a proper way. And the things like that they changed were very, very small changes. The other one similar to that is at his Wimbledon concert in this film, it infers that he knows that he has AIDS.
Yeah.
In real life, when he performed at the Wimbledon, he wasn't yet aware of his AIDS.
Well, that change I like because it adds a certain poignancy to that performance.
It matches perfectly with that performance, yeah.
Yeah, especially, like, you know, wrapping up with We Are the Champions. And I think that's, like, the best part of the movie. And if, you know, sort of sitting there for 2 hours till it gets to, like, basically... It recreated the entire Live Aid concert, mm-hmm. and it does so in this.
You're in the audience.
Yeah, it's like it's an exceptionally well done recreation, mm-hmm. and sort of worth the price of admission on its own.
Mm-hmm. Also, I just wanted to say I apologize. I disagree with you when it comes to the focus on Brian May. It deals with it in the film. People view Freddie Mercury as Queen, right?
Yeah.
And because of that, of course, making the film, they want the fans to enjoy it. It does focus more on Freddie Mercury, but it delved more into the drummer and Brian May, the guitarist, than I thought. It shows their, you know, their partners. It shows them partying. It shows how they dealt with Freddie Mercury coming out. It deals with the drummer's wife, her thoughts on homosexuality. You know, small little references.
Yeah, they're small.
Yeah, but I think, like, for the band Queen, it's even more than I would expect. They're good friends with Adam Lambert, and they said they loved the film and that it focused, like, a pinch more on them than they thought. It focuses more on them than it did in real life when Queen was around or around with Freddie Mercury.
I mean, yeah, they're part of the... a lot of the sequences are, like, there's a personal dilemma in the band, and it's sort of resolved by them, like, making one of their iconic songs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that, but, you know, which does focus on the band, which I like. And I like the sequence where they're putting together Bohemian Rhapsody.
Mm-hmm. Also,
it's like the forensic sort of analysis of how that song came together, yeah, was really good. But, I mean, just, like, in the moment where they're at, like, where Freddie Mercury's having this wild party, and the bandmates are there, and you can tell they're, like, kind of uncomfortable with, like, the direction, yeah, this is going in. And it's just, like, kind of ends with them leaving the party. And then we don't sort of address that outside of what's within Freddie Mercury's point of view.
Well, because, yeah, because the film didn't need to take a full focus on that. Just the way that the drummer, that's the scene I was talking about, just the way the drummer's wife,
right, yeah,
looks at him and, you know, says to him that they need to go, it's pretty clear that part of the reason they didn't like the vibe of that party is because there was, you know, a lot of gay individuals.
I get that, but I think that we see a lot of Freddie Mercury without the band, and I think it would have been a bit more balanced if we had seen sort of what the band was without Freddie Mercury, even if that sort of maybe delves into maybe some of the uglier side, like homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, that's one issue I have. and I kind of enjoyed sitting there watching this. I just want to say
I
enjoyed it.
But yeah, I was surprised with your first comment being negative. I thought this was a fantastic film.
But when I started autopsying it in my head, I sort of was running into problems. And, you know, the other thing was they introduce his family early on, his father, mm-hmm. clearly disapproving mm-hmm. father. And then that's kind of, like, wrapped up in the end with a nice hug, and there's, like, kind of nothing in between.
That did happen in real life, but it was about, you know, a few weeks before the Wimbledon thing. Whereas in this film, yes, his final talk with his dad is right before it. But that's, like I was saying, that is such a small change, and it makes it more enjoyable.
I'm not mad about the change. I'm not mad at all. My problem is that we introduce the father. We introduce that there's this friction,
mm-hmm.
and then we don't address it again until, like, 20 minutes before the end of the movie.
Well, because I think part of their separation was they didn't talk, right? I think that's, yeah, partly what they showed. The reason their relationship was so hard is because, based on their culture and just the way they live, you can't talk about, like, 90% of the things the father and the son wanted to express.
Right, but I think
especially when he, not necessarily came out, but joined that community.
Right, but I think there's ways to address that, you know, that doesn't leave it literally unsaid until the very end of the movie. I think there's a scene where Freddie Mercury meets Jim Hutton, and Jim's talking about how Freddie doesn't know himself and isn't comfortable with himself yet. And I think that's very true, but I don't think the film really kind of deals with that. And instead it cuts to like these, lavish parties or a concert sequence. It's trying to do a lot of things. First of all, it wants to, like, how did Queen become the band that it is musically?
Yeah.
And then the other part is about, like, how did, Freddie Mercury sort of descend into, realms of, personal struggle and coming to terms with his queer identity. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, they made Paul Prenter sort of like stereotypically sinister gay guy who's dragging Freddie Mercury into deeper pits of debauchery and inappropriateness.
Apparently he was a bit of a, I was trying to think of not a swear, a jerk in real life.
I gathered that. Mm-hmm. But there's ways you can make people jerkish without making him sort of like sit there in the back of the limo and lure like Aidan Gillen into getting himself fired and this Machiavelli thing.
No, I like that little kind of feud he has with, what's his name? Littlefinger. You'll know who I mean when I say Littlefinger. We were talking about Game of Thrones.
The character's name is Aidan Gillen, the actor's name is Aidan Gillen.
Yeah, and Aidan Gillen was really great. And I do, what you were just talking about, that kind of limo scene, I guess they made Paul's character a bit too singularly evil.
Yeah, it was like a very snidely whiplash scene. I lured you to your doom, yeah. Aidan Gillen.
Part of it and why they didn't delve more deeply into some of the things you were talking about is because it wanted to show the full Queen's career up until their last concert, right? And it wanted it to be enjoyable for everybody. So it didn't want to, well, they didn't want to make it like Oliver. The Doors, Oliver Stone's like 3 hours, isn't it? It's pretty long. It didn't want that. It wanted it to be more enjoyable for a broader audience.
All Oliver Stone movies end up being 3 hours eventually, even if it's in a director's cut.
Yeah. Malcolm X is really long too, but it accomplished it. I don't know if this film would have, so I am glad that they kind of just stuck with the basic. I don't want to say basic because it did delve deeply into it. It made me learn some new things, but I'm glad it was more just a broad view and look into Queen's career. I do agree with you, though, that maybe it did focus a pinch too much on Freddie Mercury.
I don't think there was a focus. I think the focus was all over the place. And I think if they wanted to make a movie about the band, that's fine. If you want to make a movie about Freddie Mercury, then that's fine. But if you want to make a film about how Freddie Mercury struggled with his queer identity and how maybe he was led down, paths by people who were, like, exploiting his fame and his wealth.
But I think if they'd have to make the full film focus more.
I know, on but one of those. But I know. I just wish they would have chose one, because I think because Freddie Mercury is also a gay icon, and there were actually people angry about some of the earlier trailers because it seemed to like quote unquote whitewash that side of Freddie Mercury. It didn't,
What do you mean?
That some of the trailers didn't like directly address the fact that he
that he's gay,
that he was gay, and that he died of AIDS, and
because he wasn't just gay,
gay, but I mean because he's an icon, people were worried that that was going to be whitewashed, that the movie wasn't going to address that at all.
But it's the film accurately showed how Freddie Mercury himself dealt with a lot of troubles when it comes to it. So it wouldn't have made sense if in the trailer like one of the main focuses was him coming out. It would make him seem more like a Milk or something like that, right? That's not the kind of biopic it is.
But at the same time, it's part of his life story. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the film wants to deal with it, but it also wants to deal with it antiseptically too, by just showing like, people in, leather chaps and like, what's going on here, rather than sort of like not necessarily be explicit. Like, I'm not saying the movie had to be R-rated or anything like that. But it felt like very much the way you would have made this in like the 1990s, where it's like you want to be sure that people know he's gay, but you don't want the movie to be too gay because then otherwise you're going to turn off straight people.
It being more of a hush thing, actually, for me, made it feel more realistic in the sense that it was the majority of the 70s, 80s, right. Especially in the States, because the AIDS outbreak in the 80s, homosexuality was not viewed in a positive way. And it was, you know, a lot of people as a result, and still in the States, unfortunately, are feeling the need to stay closeted, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why there was a lot of just kind of homoerotic little glances and kind of hints that right. he might come out later, like even early on in the film.
Right, but that's sort of seeing it through the lens of the setting.
Yeah.
And but we're watching this through the modern audience, and we don't have to have our hands held.
Mm.
And I feel like the movie was holding our hands, like, okay, it's going to get a bit gay, but not so gay that you might think you might become gay,
mm-hmm.
which is weird considering that Bryan Singer is himself a gay man.
Wow.
I mean, I recognize
he's very too a female, issues. But yeah.
But
he's got some ancient Greek vibes in him. That's what he's got, you know.
that's a diplomatic way of putting it. but yeah, it's just the tone felt a bit off, and I
agree with that to a small degree.
Okay,
I think the part where they go on their first large tour,
yeah.
and it's just all of a sudden like just rainbow titles, Rio, Tokyo, London.
Yes.
That really just did not fit into the. That might not have been. You said after Bryan Singer left, right? Maybe that was the other director's choice or something.
The other weird part was...
Bring your kid to work day, and the editor brought his kid to work day and did that little part. That's a possibility.
That could be it. The other part that was weird was after Bohemian Rhapsody comes out, and they're in... I can't remember the character. The Mike Myers record exec.
Yeah.
And And they're arguing back and forth about what should be released as a single, and then it like goes it's
Ray Foster, EMI executive.
Ray Foster, but then Freddie Mercury's sitting at the radio station where he's like releasing the Bohemian Rhapsody mm-hmm. behind the record company's back, and there's this window that's blacked out, and then the camera pans to the blacked window, and it becomes the video for Bohemian Rhapsody, mm-hmm. and then all the quotes that are like. All the negative criticisms of yeah. Bohemian Rhapsody are coming out. And like,
that didn't work
what
so
What is
well.
This, pop-up video?
And they had already showed them making the music video for Bohemian Rhapsody. Or yeah. at least they showed them producing a Bohemian Rhapsody. And the music video for it was also them just singing right?
Yeah.
They already had references the part in the music video where their foreheads together and are singing. So I don't know why they had to show, like you said, an actual remake.
It was, yeah, it's just, it was.
That was just a small thing, though.
It's a small thing, but it really shows that, you know, they didn't know how to, like, really transition from different scenes. And so they would do these, like, random things, like do the title cards with the towns they're going to, or they'd cut to, like, 3 years later or what have you. And that's the kind of stuff that's really irksome in the mm-hmm. in the biopic sort of mold. Is
do it to a noticeable degree of being irked. For me.
Yeah.
But maybe I wasn't, you know, I wasn't paying close enough attention. I thought some of the rainbow one I was talking about was wild, but some of the just more like, you know, white text titles, I was okay with that. Just more simplistic.
Yeah. But
I do know what you mean.
There's a lot of, you know, jumping. And this is the kind of stuff that like Dewey Cox was like sending up
mm-hmm.
10 years ago. I think that movie came out and we're still haven't sort of evolved. And this is kind of like... To make a biopic about Queen, it's kind of like the last band of its kind that hasn't gotten this treatment yet, the biopic treatment. So
I don't think Zeppelin has either, but
Zeppelin hasn't, AC/DC hasn't. I mean, if we're just, you mm-hmm. know, maybe there'll be a Guns N' Roses biopic yeah. one day. I don't know, but it just
you mean of like the big bands.
The big bands.
Yeah.
It just seems like we can be innovating a bit more and maybe not doing the...
I don't know if I thought this was a great film. I think the minor flaws that I said, like the titles and what you said, the different directors, the flow does not match. But I think, honestly, with those things I was saying, that's like maybe 5 minutes that doesn't work and that maybe doesn't feel right. But even just Rami Malek himself was...
He was great.
He was great. He was Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
Oh, I
yeah.
viewed him as Freddie Mercury. I forgot he was Rami Malek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he was great. Like, from the first scene where he talks to Brian and Roger after the show, mm-hmm. and their lead singer has quit, he's talking about, like, I also write some songs, and they're like, oh, that'd be great, but our lead singer, and he goes, well, you'll need someone new. And he just, like, just that kind of confidence, mm-hmm. and...
First date with what was the character's name? Yeah, Lucy Boynton, Mary Austin.
Yeah,
she's my age, by the way, which I thought was really weird. She looks older. I thought their connection was very interesting, and that was actually, in a weird way, one of the most accurate in real life. Mm-hmm. They stayed besties.
Yeah,
they stayed best friends till the day he died. And yeah, they double dated constantly, like it shows at the end with her eventual husband and his partner.
Yes, that's one of the things I thought the movie got really, really mm-hmm. right, was that it makes you understand, even though he was gay, why, you know, he's still calling her the love of his life, why that relationship was valuable, mm-hmm. Why it was a loving relationship, even though it's a queer man and a straight woman. That was really, really well done, and they were really, really good together. Mm-hmm. And Lucy Boynton, I think, is someone to watch because she was in The Black Coat's Daughter, which Candace and I reviewed a few mm-hmm. months ago, and yeah, she was really good in that, too. So she's a really talented actress, and Rami Malek is a really talented actor.
This is my first Rami Malek anything, and even with just that, I fully agree.
I mean, yeah,
Mr. Robot apparently is.
Mr. Robot, I haven't seen.
Yeah, but I've only heard good
things. Because it's one of those things you can't stream in Canada. Anyway. So yeah, he's good. In this, I've seen him in a couple of TV shows where he's done guest appearances. I think mm-hmm. he was in Band of Brothers too, or he was in the Pacific. He was in one of the two.
I think Pacific.
So, I mean, he's someone whose star is on the rise, but he's also someone with, like, a unique look. And, but you're right. He really does become Freddie Mercury, especially when he's doing, like, those reenactments, the Live Aid concert, which is, like, really the only Queen concert I've ever seen because I've seen the footage.
Yeah.
And
it's a really good Montreal one. That was the one thing that really peeved me off. They showed the rainbow colored title pages we were saying, right? They showed the name of literally like 20 different places. They don't show a single Canadian place they went. And Montreal is one of their most well-known concerts. It's phenomenal.
Well, there you go. Yeah, and you think Bryan Singer would have like a Canada bias because he's like all the X-Men movies were shot here?
Yeah.
But I think Days and Future Past and Apocalypse were both shot in Montreal. Mm-hmm. But
well, the Wolverine looks like it is too. I know, but Bryan Singer was not connected to that.
But
it's also set in Canada, so of course it, yeah.
Yeah, Wolverine's Canadian.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's Canada, Bryan Singer? Anyway, and then I do want to give credit where credit's due to Mike Myers. I think
yes,
his cameo was, or not even cameo, but his small part mm-hmm. as Ray Forrester was like so great, and like the poker face as he's dealing like these like over the top mm-hmm. musicians.
And there is
brilliant.
If you're a Wayne's World fan, there's the one like little shot for shot reference to it. He's yeah. bobbing his head to Bohemian Rhapsody is listening to
yeah,
it
yeah.
in a negative way. But in the exact same way as he did in Wayne's World.
Yeah, it's like nobody's gonna be bobbing their head mm-hmm. to Bohemian Rhapsody. He literally says that. It's that was a treat that I liked a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, as I said, as I was sitting there enjoying it, but, you know, there are like loose threads that I sort of start picking on. I think that it does an incredible job of highlighting the mm-hmm. music of Queen. I think that it does that service really well. And if the band members feel like that they're well represented, that's fine. That's, you know, their prerogative.
I think, honestly,
it's their story. But
they know what it was like in the 70s and 80s. I think they're cool with it.
I
know what you mean though. You wanted it to be more of a main focus on them.
I think there was more value in sort of going deeper. It's like, cause the a lot of the music they deal with is like the Queen standards. We mm-hmm. will rock you. We are the champions. Bohemian Rhapsody. You're my best friend. And you know, it's
70s ride.
Right. So we get the music. We know the music, but do we know like the story behind the scenes and just, you know, some of the things like the Evil Paul, you know,
mm-hmm.
being the puppet master and not returning, you know, Tom Hollander's calls about, you know, mm-hmm. Live Aid and things like that. Stuff like that left a bad taste in my mouth. But I mean, overall, I think the performances are really good. The music's mm-hmm. really good.
The music was
the staging
fantastic.
Of the concert scenes was. Well, especially the Live
Equivalent
Aid sequence.
To A Star Is Born when it comes to how real it looks, right? I'd say even more. I felt more.
Well, it's even more because
within the Freddie Mercury concerts than I did in A Star Is Born.
Well, the Star Is Born like puts you like right on stage and like right in people's faces. Especially the Live 8 one, where it was in Wimbledon and like thousands of people, so the sweeping panoramas of the stadium.
You're viewing it as people in the audience and people behind the stage,
yep.
Like the people he loves.
Yep. Yep. And yeah, that last sequence is incredibly powerful, and it leaves you with a lump in your throat. So, I mean,
it does. I'm gonna admit it. I cheered up. When he played Radio Gaga,
yeah,
and it showed that one old guy tearing up and like clapping along with it, I was like, "Oh man,
yeah,
just give me them feels."
Yeah, so it has the feels, but with some reservations, at least for me.
If you're a Queens fan, which I am, you're gonna love the heck out of it.
Oh, well, there you go.
And if you are a Queen fan and you don't love the heck out of it, it's because you like Sacha Baron Cohen a bit too much. All right.
Wow.
Oh, I love Sacha Baron Cohen, but.
I'm not sure how many people are carrying that torch, but we have to wrap up the show for this week. You can listen to our show at our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. And Peter, if people want to continue your Queen love, where can they find you?
Yeah, because I'm going to rant about it. This is our biggest disagreement thus far, I think. I thought it was remarkable. So yeah, tweet after tweet is what I'm going to do on Mr. Tarak. And maybe a YouTube video also on Mr. Tarak. So that's it for me.
Is this a beef now?
No.
All right. You can find me tomorrow on CFRU at 5 p.m. for news and politics with Scotty Hertz, and that's on Open Sources Guelph. I am on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.ca to find my political stuff. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will see you next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. And we'll see you then.